And if a corporation has constitutional rights, what that means is there are certain things that we, the people, cannot do to a corporation.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, David Cobb will introduce us to the concept of corporate personhood and the idea that money should be protected as speech. If that gets you as worked up as he is on the topic, he'll also give you some ideas for what you can do about it. I'm Stephanie Zavan, producer of The Humanist Hour. We're happy to announce that this show marks our return to a weekly schedule. We're also experimenting with our format a little bit this week. Give it a listen and let us know what you think. David Cobb is a lawyer and co-founder of Move to Amend, a coalition dedicated to winning a constitutional amendment to firmly establish that money is not speech and that human beings, not corporations, are persons entitled to constitutional rights. He's sued corporate polluters, lobbied elected officials, run for public office himself, and been arrested for nonviolent civil disobedience. He believes we must use every tool available to effect the systemic social change we so desperately need. In 2002, David ran for Attorney General of Texas, pledging to use the office to revoke the charters of corporations that repeatedly violate health, safety, and environmental laws. In 2004, he ran for President of the United States on the Green Party ticket and successfully campaigned for the Ohio recount. At the American Humanist Association's annual conference in Denver in May 2015, David discussed the legal doctrine of corporate constitutional rights and the idea that money should be treated as speech. He contended that these illegitimate, irrational, court-created concepts have allowed a small ruling elite to hijack the social, political, and economic institutions of our country. He described the growing efforts of Move to Amend, a multiracial, multi-ethnic, intergenerational mass movement demanding a constitutional amendment to abolish these doctrines. He also made the case that humanists are uniquely positioned to attack and discredit these concepts. He provided concrete ways members of the AHA might get involved as individuals or through their existing chapters. In this week's show, we bring you the audio from David's speech to introduce him and his ideas to a broader audience.
Since we're talking about corporate personhood, do we have any corporations in the audience today? Okay, funny. Corporations don't attend humanist meetings, so they must be at the other meetings. Do we have any presidential candidates in the office? Anybody who has run for president in the audience? Okay, another question. Has anybody been arrested for civil disobedience? Anybody in the audience arrested for civil disobedience? So, now the odd thing is I am 100% certain that two of those three things, people with two of those three categories are in the audience today. Our speaker, David Cobb, ran for president, did not raise his hand. Our speaker, David Cobb, has been arrested for civil disobedience and did not raise his hand. So I don't know why not, but these are all qualities that you can attribute to this excellent speaker that we have today to talk about corporate personhood. And he's an excellent speaker for this because throughout his life he's become a lawyer and he understands the law and he speaks from a knowledge of this concept, this legal concept of corporate personhood. And he understands because he started the Move to Amend organization, a multiracial organization, which they say very specifically because they recognize the structures, the context, the situations that cause a lot of the racial unrest and the racial problems in society, also with sexism, LGBT rights and whatnot. This political power that corporations have causes a lot of issues that need to be resolved by focusing on people and not looking at corporations as exactly the same as people because they have different qualities. So it's very good that we have him here today as head of an organization that's been working around the country with his expertise as a lawyer, which his background as a candidate, and his colleague Ruthie here today as well. So there are two of them with their Move to Amend buttons. And the most important thing that he wants you to know, and that I want, that I'm excited about today, is that he is an engaged citizen. From the grassroots level, being arrested if he has to understand what he needs to do, doing work every day, to start organizations, to go all around the country to make sure that social change happens, to improve the country that he is a citizen of, and to come here to speak to us here today. So I want to recognize David Cobb, our speaker, to come up and get us started. Thank you.
Thanks, Jason. Thank you very much. So can I see this, Jason, just for a moment? Because this is the program, and in this program, I'm going to try this because I'd like to be able, how are we doing? Oh, great. Because in the program, I specifically pledge that in 50 minutes, I would lay out the legal principles for what corporations are, why corporations do not have constitutional rights, and challenge myself to specifically make the case that humanists are uniquely poised to take this issue and move forward. Oh, and by the way, I said I'd do that in 50 minutes. So we gotta get started, right? And we're gonna do this very clearly. I wanna start, I am not being sycophantic with this group. I do believe that humanists are uniquely poised to begin to critique and build a movement against the concept of corporations having constitutional rights, because this group, as a matter of definition, says rational thought and reasoning ought to be at the very focus of public policy and decision making. Do I have the crowd right? Okay, right? So I just think that it's really worth pointing out that the idea that corporations have constitutional rights and that money is political speech is just stupid, right? It's just not rational at all. And so I really do want to challenge you as humanists to consider if this is a movement and an organization that you might invest your own personal time into. And since I really do want to, quote, make the case, I want to start by saying if we're going to deal with the legal system, we got to start with the supreme law of the land. What is that called? The U.S. Constitution. How many of y'all have read the U.S. Constitution? David, I'm looking to make sure you raise your hand. All right, good. A lot of hands go up. This is, David, of course, is the general counsel for the American Humanist Association, so just wanted to make sure he raised his hand. Here's the thing. When you read the Constitution in its entirety, I'm going to submit to you, you'll see two concepts, right? I don't mean just reading the words, because obviously you have to read words to read. But to really understand something, as my mama taught me, son, you have to look for patterns. You have to look for systems. You have to really go beyond merely words and understand conceptually what's at play. When you look at the Constitution that way, you will see two major concepts. The first concept is the most important concept. In fact, it's so important, it's the first three words. We the people. Those are hallowed words in this country, and they should be. Because you see, we the people come together to create the second concept, which is government itself. Saying it this way, we the people create government. Government is dependent upon we the people. I like how some of my colleagues say it. They say the people should never be afraid of the government. Actually, they say government should be afraid of the people. How many of y'all believe government is afraid of the people? Oh, a couple of hands go up, right? It's a slow burn question, because here's a follow-up. If government is not afraid of we the people, why are they spying on us? It's a serious thing. Think about it. Because whether you are a Democrat or a Republican, a Libertarian, a Green, an Independent, I submit this to you. For the past 50 years in this country, there has been more surveillance on the people of the United States, regardless of what party was in the White House, regardless of what party was in control of Congress. A security state and a surveillance state is being slowly imposed upon us because government is actually afraid of us. And you know what else? The corporate elite are afraid of us too. And if you don't think the corporate elite are afraid of us, I got one word for you. Occupy. Right? The Occupy movement. I had the privilege of traveling around the country during the Occupy encampment era
probably went to 50, 60 Occupy encampments. And you know what I saw there? I saw people talking to each other. That's what I saw. Now see, the ruling elite and the corporations and the heads of government, they want us to talk to each other, provided we talk about sports and celebrity and fashion and gadgets to buy. But what scared the ruling elite was that the Occupy movement, people were asking, why do 25% of the children go to bed hungry in the richest country the world has ever seen? Why does 1% rule over 99% in a country that claims to be a democracy? They were asking things like, what is the Federal Reserve? And why is it, as a private banking consortium, in control of the money supply in a country that claims to be a democratic republic? See, they were asking what Audre Lorde, the great poetess, calls unsanctioned conversation. We're not supposed to have those conversations, and it scared the ruling elite when they saw that people were having that level of conversation in a coherent way all across the country. And I'm going to tell y'all, for real, if I could ever look like in the eyes and be as close as I am to Jason right now and talk to a member of the real ruling elite, and I don't even mean the 1%, I mean the billionaire class, the 0.001%. who really run everything. If I only had 60 seconds and I could actually look him in the eye, you know what I think I'd say? I'd say, don't be scared of us. Because we are actually a peaceful, loving, and compassionate people. And I know that right now you're so addicted to the crack pipe of power and wealth accumulation that, like every other addict, all you can see is your next hit of power and wealth accumulation. But I promise you that your children and your grandchildren are going to be grateful that we, the people, finally got our act together and staged a nonviolent intervention on your addicted ass. That's what I would tell them. Because I challenge you, that's how we have to start thinking. We have to recognize that we have to stage an intervention on this billionaire class because, frankly, folks, they are not only harming themselves. If they were only harming themselves, my libertarian instincts would say, I wish they wouldn't do that, but it's their body, it's their life, they can do it. But what I know, what you know, is they are destroying the planet that we depend upon for life itself. We must intervene and stop them. And the last speaker did a pretty good job of showing us how our window of opportunity is actually closing. We're going to have to move, and we're going to have to move quickly. We, the people, actually do have the power to be able to do that within the framework of how our constitutional republic is supposed to operate.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Stephanie Zavan. Today, we're listening to David Cobb's speech on corporate personhood from the May 2015 American Humanist Association annual conference in Denver.
You see, in the U.S. Constitution, we the people are understood to be free and sovereign. And the word sovereign is very important because the word sovereign means the authority to rule. See, the king isn't sovereign here anymore, right? We kicked him out. But check this out. Government isn't sovereign over the people. Government doesn't have the authority to rule over us. Actually, government is supposed to be subordinate and accountable. Government is supposed to be subordinate to whom? The people. Government is supposed to be accountable to whom? The people. I like how this is going. Let's continue. We the people are free and sovereign because we the people have rights. Government does not have rights. Government only has duties. And as a lawyer, I'm going to really stop for a moment to underscore the difference. You see, if you've got the right to do something, ma'am, it means you can do it. You don't need my permission. You don't need this group's permission. You don't need the City Council of Denver's permission. You don't need the President of the United States' permission or Congress's permission. You have the right to do something. By golly, you can do it. This is a very powerful idea. Our constitutional rights are not subject to the political process. You have them because you are a human being. They are inherent. They are inalienable. You step into those rights the moment that you step into your humanity. This is a very important idea. And government never has rights over the people. Government only has duties to the people. And duties under law are different. Duties are responsibilities. So if you have a responsibility to do something, you must do it, right? And in fact, as an individual, if you do not actually discharge your duty properly, then you can be sued under contract law or under tort law. You can be sued for breaching some duty that you have. It's a very powerful idea, this notion of duty. And government only has duties. Where do those duties come from? Well, remember, all power resides with the people. The people have the power. But that brings me to this pop quiz question. Anybody know what the population is, more or less, of Denver, Colorado? How many people live here? About 500,000? About 500,000 in the city of. It may be more, but I'll tell you this. I will celebrate that 500,000 or more individuals in the city of Denver control politically Denver's municipal politics and elections. They have all of the power. That's a true statement. I'll honor that statement. But I would tell you this. I would hate to go to a meeting of 500,000 people where we decide where should stop signs go in Denver. And I like political meetings, but I'm not going to that one. Can you imagine the chaos? Because it's not just stop signs. You've got to make decisions about wastewater, and you've got to make decisions about schools and libraries and healthcare. You see, the point is that there is a lot to how public policy and government operates. We, the people, cannot get together and make every single decision every time. But we do hold all the political power. But in our constitutional republican form of government, we, the people who hold all the power, delegate a certain amount of our power to government. Do we delegate all our power to government? No, we only delegate enough power for government to perform the duties that we, the people, have told them that we want them to perform. And how does government perform those duties? They write public policy, public laws. Folks, there is going to be disagreement about public policy. Maybe you've noticed. And I will tell you something for real. I feel like we're losing something in this country because we're forgetting how to have rigorous, vigorous public debate without being disagreeable. This is something that's really important, and especially as humanists, I challenge you to be able to conduct yourself with civility, with courtesy, with respect, with people even with whom, especially with whom, you may have very fierce disagreements. Because if we're not capable of doing that, then we never have the opportunity to actually learn from another, teach one another, or even engage in an actual democratic republic. So I will tell you this. I personally make the commitment through the course of the Q&A that we'll do and the discussion and out in the hall, and I'm here for the entire conference. I hope if any of you are inspired by the work of Move to Mend, you'll come and chat me up. And even if we disagree, I will be respectful to you. And I am respectful to everyone, especially those people with whom they disagree, because I think it's really that important. And I also want to point something out. It's not just that we have to engage in respectful discourse around public policy. We also have to be willing to honor public policy and the political process, even when we disagree with it, because that is the nature of how our public process is supposed to operate. We elect representatives. The elected representatives are responsible for and they are delegated with the authority and the responsibility to make public policy and public laws. But remember this, the one thing in our system that the public process cannot do is to violate anybody's private constitutional rights. So now that I've taken the time to put this all out, I think to myself, wow, this is brilliant. This is beautiful. I mean, we the people have rights that are sacred and sacrosanct, but we discharge to the government the responsibility to write public policy, but public policy cannot violate our private rights. I look at that and I think, this is amazing. We should try that in this country. This would totally work. Right? And I'm not joking. This would work. I'm not joking that this is beautiful. And I'm also not joking, folks, and this is where I challenge some of you, perhaps, in assumptions that we've had. I know I was challenged the first time I heard it, but I'm going to lay it out because I think it's the truth. The United States of America has never actually been a functioning democratic republic. Notwithstanding what I was taught as a child, notwithstanding what I wanted, notwithstanding what I deserved, the United States of America was never a functioning democracy because the word democracy has a very specific meaning. It actually comes, anybody know what language that's from?
Greek.
Greek, very good. Demos means the people. Kratia, K-R-A-T-I-A in Attic Greek. Anybody know what that means? Power or rule. So literally the word democracy means the people rule. And if y'all believe we the people are ruling in the United States? Don't be shy. Look around. Not a single one of you raised your hands because you know what I know, and that is that notwithstanding the creation myth of this country, notwithstanding what we are taught as children in this country, we the people are not actually ruling. In fact, let's actually tell the truth. A small ruling elite are ruling in this country. And when I say small, I mean a billionaire class. I mean literally, there are a handful of uber stinking filthy rich people who are in control of virtually all of our society. And there is a masquerade to try to hide that. But I'll tell you, I give this presentation all across the country. I gave last year almost 150 presentations. I asked the question, who believes the people ruling the United States? Almost nobody ever raises their hands. That's a problem. But saying it another way, I submit to you, it's a good thing. What? No. It's not a good thing that we the people don't rule. It's a good thing that people are waking up and being willing to confront the truth. That notwithstanding what we want and what we deserve, we the people are not ruling. And again, as humanist, I'm making the case and the appeal that you ought to recognize the importance of people being willing to challenge assumptions that they have been imposed by the culture in which they're living and confront truth and reality. The truth of the matter is there is a ruling elite in this country that's preventing we the people from ruling ourselves. And I'll get back to the constitutional framework. Because I'll submit this. We have to really understand, you know, I think the concepts here are brilliant. I absolutely support them. How am I doing, by the way, David, in terms of this basic constitutional principle and human beings having constitutional rights? Are you with me? Yeah? So, again, you're a lawyer. All I'm pointing out, friends, is that there's not a problem with the concept. But now I've got to actually go a little deeper and ask somebody, tell me what year the U.S. Constitution is ratified. When does the Constitution become the supreme law of the land? It's 1789. I heard 1787 was the convention that actually proposed it. Secret convention, by the way. Totally worth it, looking at the history. But 1789 is when the Constitution becomes the supreme law of the land. The reason I want that specific date on the board is to ask you, in 1789, who was a legal person who could claim the rights of the Constitution? What were their characteristics? White, male, landowners. That's a lot of restrictions, isn't it? In fact, would anybody like to hazard a guess about what percentage of the human beings living in the newly formed United States of America could actually claim to fully have constitutional rights and all the protections of that august document? What percentage? 20%? 1%. Yeah, the 1% meme is pretty good. I like that. We are the 99%. I still get turned on chanting that. But come on, 1%. Don't be so cynical. But 20%, you're not cynical enough. Because the answer is 5%. Wow. Think about it. What that means is 95% of the adult human beings living in the United States of America when it was initially founded were literally not legal persons who could claim constitutional rights. And here is the point. First of all, none of the indigenous human beings who were already here could claim to be persons under this Constitution. In fact, this document did not protect them against efforts at intentional genocide. And we need to actually be willing to confront that and tell the truth. You're with me, I see. I got some strong support over here from this young man. Thank you. And this document did not protect the enslaved Africans who had been brought at the barrel of a gun and the force of a bayonet blade and forced to build this country with slave labor. This document, for all its concepts, actually codified the enslavement of Africans, codified the idea of slavery, and they were so clever that they didn't even use the word slave or slavery. And yet, it was literally codified in this document. And this document did not protect women, because women were not persons for the purposes of the Constitution. In fact, women, properly understood under law, were chattel property. They were the property of the men in their lives, first their fathers and then later their husbands. And never mind if you wanted to marry marry a woman, because that's not even on the table. So, at the end of the day, white working class men are not people either, because they don't have rights. Only 5%, right? And so it took social movements, broad, deep, that were willing to challenge the cultural assumptions that changed and made our country more democratic, more just, more fair. And now I'm going to write the word corporation on the board, because after all, the corporation is the most dominant institution on planet Earth. But before I write on the board, I want to, anybody know what it takes to form a corporation in, say, Colorado today? That's exactly right. And you just have to identify somebody to be president, somebody to be treasurer, and somebody to be secretary. And as long as your $75 filing fee is paid, then poof, the Secretary of State will issue you a charter and the corporation is born. A corporation is a function of the government to issue that charter. Oh, now I'll take you back to 1789 and tell you what it once took to form a corporation. And this was true in every country, every state in this union. First, your application didn't go to some trivial clerk. It went to the state House of Representatives, where they debated it, discussed it, and you had to get a majority vote. But not just of the state House of Representatives, it also went to the state Senate, where you had to get a majority vote. And then after that, it went to the governor, who had to be willing to sign it. Does that sound anything like a corporate charter today? Of course not. What did I just describe? Majority vote of the House, majority vote of the Senate. Governor signs it. Law. Think about it. The idea, the concept of even creating a limited liability corporation for 100 years in this country was understood to be a political act that was completely politically controlled, because the concept of limiting your legal liability was a privilege, not a right. Oh, and by the way, if you were granted a corporate charter, all you could do was the specific type of business that you would ask to do. And if you did any other type of business, guess what happened to your corporate charter? Revoked. Corporate charters were revoked for going ultra vires or beyond the authority of why specifically they had been created. Oh, and get this. If the corporate charter was issued, they were typically only good for 10 years. And at the end of that 10 years, you had to reapply politically all over again. Oh, and get this, even if you were operating in your 10 years, even if you were doing the specific type of business that you had asked to do, if you ever did anything that was held to violate the public trust, guess what happened to your corporate charter? Revoked. Corporate charters were once routinely revoked in this country for merely acting outside the public interest, which leads me to this pop quiz question. Somebody name a single one of the Fortune 500 corporations that could even operate today with the political restrictions that the founders put on the corporate form. I'll wait. None. Now look, there are hundreds of thousands of corporations that would still operate, but I'm just pointing out that these huge mega transnational corporations would not be allowed to operate under the political restrictions of the Constitution that the founders had created. Now, and remember, I'm not a founder fetishist, right? I actually am willing to say what is good about the constitutional concept, even as I critique the racism, the sexism, the genocide. So we have to be willing to tell all of the truth. And so here it comes, folks. Now that we know that it takes an action of state government to create the corporate charter, we understand that the corporate charter can be used to hold the corporation subordinate and accountable. We understand that the corporation can only do and has the duty to do what that charter says it can do. And we understand that the corporate charter's creation is through the public process and should only be allowed the privilege of existing if serving the public interest. Isn't it obvious that a corporation should go here where the founders had it? And now, my friends, I thank you for your patience, because here comes the punchline. When the U.S. Supreme Court comes waltzing in, and an act of supreme judicial activism, by the way, says, notwithstanding prior court decisions, notwithstanding the founders' original intent, notwithstanding common damn sense, five of us are going to tell 310 million of you, from now on, you have to treat a corporation not as the artificial entity created under the public process to do commerce that it's actually supposed to be, but you now have to treat a corporation as it's a person with rights under this document, and that perverts the whole thing. See, corporate personhood is a shorthand for the illegitimate, totally made up, totally court-created idea that a corporation is a person with constitutional rights. And if a corporation has constitutional rights, what that means is there are certain things that we, the people, cannot do to a corporation. Which means that the corporation, which is just a construct, just a way of organizing capital, now corporate lawyers can go into court and challenge and try to overturn environmental protection laws, worker safety laws, public health laws, campaign finance laws.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Stephanie Zavan. Today, we're listening to David Cobb's speech on corporate personhood from the May 2015 American Humanist Association annual conference in Denver.
There's not a single law that we can pass now, even if we work our butts off in this corrupted political system, that then corporate lawyers can't go into the legal system and have it overturned. Because here's the thing, when the Supreme Court turns a political question like environmental protection, worker safety, how to deal with business, how to deal with campaign finance law, all of those are political questions that there's going to be debate on. But if you turn, and we allow the court to turn a political question into a constitutional law question, they have just made we the people spectators rather than engaged citizens, where we just sit back and let the ruling elite and the billionaire class rule over us. So as I'm coming to the end of the formal presentation, here is the idea. How am I doing? Look at that. So, Move to Amend is a multiracial, multi-ethnic campaign that challenges two entrenched, established legal doctrines, not just a court decision, but bedrock concepts under law. One that says corporations have constitutional rights. No, not true. Corporations are artificial entities created under the political process. They have privileges under law, but not inherent inalienable rights. Secondly, the idea that money is political speech. No, money is property. And the concept that money can somehow constitutionally be spent willy-nilly is actually a very recent idea. It was actually first created by the Supreme Court in Buckley versus Vallejo in 1974. Before that, it was actually a state crime to use corporate money to even influence an election. Not just bribery, but literally, if you were found to be using corporate money to influence elections, in many states, it was literally a crime. Do you see how low we've stunk? So Move to Mend stands before you. I stand before you as a representative of Move to Mend to say, ya basta. Enough already. This is crazy. These two concepts are actually stealing our sacred right to self-government. And as a lawyer, what really pisses me off is that they're using the legal system to legalize the theft. They're telling us that we have to accept it, but we don't have to accept it. We don't have to accept it any more than women had to accept that they were not persons, any more than the abolitionists had to accept that Africans would be enslaved under right. We don't have to accept it any more than trade unionists had to accept that it was a criminal conspiracy to organize trade unions. See, what I'm challenging you as humanists is to take the ration, the intellect, the understanding that you have, and to put it into action. I'm challenging you to join us at Move to Mend to say, this is our country. We are supposed to rule in this country. And it's really that simple. So I am going to open it up for discussion. I hope I've left us enough time. But before I do this, I'm going to do two things. One, Ruthie is going to just pass out a brochure. Please take a look at it. Take one. And Ruthie, just give it big chunks because we got to get the petition going too. Make sure that each section, like, take them to the back. And on the back of the brochure is the actual proposed language that we have presented and is actually in Congress now. And think and see what you think. The second thing I want to do is to get Ruthie, to get those petitions going, a couple in the front and some in the back, because I'm inviting you to get engaged with us at Move to Amend, to actually sign up so that we can be in touch with you, including and especially if you are very active with one of your local chapters. We would love for a chapter of the American Humanist Association to work with Move to Mend local affiliates, or when we travel, to begin to build relationships together based on our shared interest. And before I open it up for conversation, I want to say this. Move to Mend was formed in 2010, the day of the Citizens United decision. We were 12 people in the living room. Today, we're 387,000 people, and we're growing every day. And we've helped 16 states call for a non-binding resolution in support of a constitutional amendment. And we've helped 600 communities pass resolutions of support of our campaign. And we've put it on the ballot in 300 local communities. We've been on the ballot 300 times. Anybody want to guess how many times we've won? 300. We haven't lost yet. And that does include Boston, Massachusetts, and San Francisco, California, and Madison, Wisconsin. You know, the liberal bastions. You know where else we've won? Salt Lake City, Utah. We won in Waukesha, Wisconsin, which is the hometown of Republican Tea Party Governor Scott Walker, where they haven't voted for a Democrat for president or Congress in 40 years. Move to Mend was on the ballot in that town, and we won. We won in the state of Montana. Yes, that Montana. 75% of the vote, y'all. What I'm telling you is that Move to Mend has figured out a way to talk to liberals and conservatives and moderates, Democrats, Republicans, Greens, Libertarians, Independents. It doesn't matter what your ideology is. What we are inviting people to recognize is that the Constitution is the principle of self-government. Move to Mend does not represent an issue. We represent the principle of self-government, and there is virtual unanimity amongst the American people about that. So that's my pitch to try to get you involved. But I want to invite people up if you want to make either a comment or a question. And I do want to say this, at the end of the day, this, I believe, is the core of whether we're going to actually have a functioning democratic republic in the United States of America.
Hi, I was just wondering, in the U.S., it's illegal for foreign persons to donate to or influence any election. So if corporations are people, how come foreign-owned corporations, or even partially foreign-owned corporations, if one Canadian citizen holds one share, yet that corporation is still allowed to influence elections?
What's Why? Your first name, sir?
Troy.
Troy, your problem is that you're applying reason and logic.
Oh, I do that all the time. I'm sorry.
Look, I'm not even joking. This idea, like, it falls on its weight as soon as you begin to ask any question, right? It doesn't make any damn sense. So I'm here to tell you, the court has created this idea. They are wrong. They have been wrong before, as they were when they said women don't have constitutional rights, when they said separate but equal does not violate the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. Like, I could go down the list. They are wrong. You are correct. That doesn't make any damn sense.
Has anybody actually brought a suit?
Well, there have been any number of suits, but this is the other problem. You would be bringing suit against the same institution, the courts, that have created the doctrine itself. Because I will tell you, and I suspect other litigators might tell you the same thing, and that is that when you are going up against entrenched law, legal arguments don't really matter. Precedent matters and culture matters. Because I know that we've got a line, so I'll be quick, but somebody tell me who Thurgood Marshall is. First African-American on the Supreme Court, but as a lawyer, he's even more famous. Why? He argued Brown versus Board of Education. Pop quiz, does anybody think that Thurgood Marshall thought of a legal argument that nobody thought of before? Of course not. Does anybody think that Thurgood Marshall was such an impassioned speaker and a good orator that he changed 9 white racists into social justice advocates overnight? Of course not. How many people believe that Brown versus Board of Education was the result of 50 years of organizing by the Anti-Lynching League, the NAACP, churches and synagogues across this country? How many people think that? See, me too. Me too. That's why I moved to Mendes Challenge us to say we have to go beyond good legal reasoning and get into the movement building game. Yes, ma'am.
Occupy Naperville started when Occupy Wall Street started, and we've been going ever since. Every Saturday we meet, we protest, we peacefully, we have General Assembly. We have our Move to Amend there, and Northern Illinois is just full of activist groups, and they're all over the United States. My question is, why don't we hear about this in the mass media?
Okay, so that is, where I'm from, a softball question. So I'll go ahead and take a swing. You don't hear it in the mass media because of whose interest the so-called mass media serves. Because you know what? I no longer call it mass media. I don't even call it mainstream media. It's corporate media. Do you know that 8 corporations control 80% of the news, information, and stories that all of us hear? The current media institutions have literally become a propaganda arm. And by the way, there is no such thing as the liberal media. The media is, the corporate media is just as liberal as the billionaires who own it. But I'm going to go you one step further and say there's actually no such thing as a conservative mainstream media either. It is a corporate media that is designed, the whole business model is designed to sell access to your eyes, your ears, your imagination space, to sell you stuff. That's how the whole thing is actually operating. So I would submit that there's not actually conservative principles being discussed any more than there are liberal or progressive principles being discussed. We are being locked out of the mainstream media, but that's the reason that we have to actually create our own media. Jello Biafra, a friend of mine and the founder of Dead Kennedys, actually said, don't hate the corporate media. become the media. Yeah. So I see several of you had been on Instagram and or taking video. I know that we've got the People's Media in the house actually recording us today. I challenge you, how many of you have Facebook? Even if you hate that you have Facebook. See, more hands go up when I ask that. If every one of you will go to Facebook and say, I just joined www.movetoamend.org. You have to have the www there. If you do that, if everybody in this crowd, over probably another 2,000 to 5,000 people will learn about us, because we are figuring out ways to go away from and under the control of the people who have been gatekeepers. So the corporate media is shutting us out on purpose.
Of the plethora of people, of politicians who have announced that they're candidates for president next year, has anyone said that they support the Move to Amend?
Not yet. The closest that we've got is Bernie Sanders. I call it like I see it.
I'm sorry, who was that?
Bernie Sanders.
Is that Bernie Sanders,
that
independent
is Bernie Sanders
of Vermont?
Independent from Vermont.
Thank you.
And Bernie has actually called specifically for a constitutional amendment that would deal with money as speech. So he is 100% on board here. We've just got to bring him along here, and I am 100% confident he's going to get there by the end of this campaign. Oh, and by the way, so before we go, on this note, I want to be clear. We at Move to Mend actually are operating something called Pledge to Amend, where we challenge candidates for office, whether it's president or Congress or state legislature, county commissioner, dog catcher. If you're running for office, we are challenging you, what is your position on corporate constitutional rights and money as speech? Yes or no? And then we're letting our supporters know the answer. And again, it doesn't matter if you're an incumbent, a challenger, a Democrat, a Republican, a Green, an independent, a libertarian, doesn't matter. Think of it this way. Move to Mend is dedicated to building a genuine, independent, grassroots movement that is not under the control of the leadership of either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. How about that? That's what it looks like when we start exercising power. Yes, sir.
Thank you, David, for the work you do. I'd just like your opinion. Are we now, or are we becoming, a fascist nation?
Boy, leave it to the American Humanist Association to drop the F word. And thank you for doing it. Benito Mussolini, the great fascist dictator and philosopher, he was a political philosopher, said fascism more properly should be called corporatism, because it merges the economic might of our mighty corporations with the military might of our nation, and he thought that was a good thing. Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, you cannot allow private corporate power to become more powerful than the democratic state. That, in essence, is the definition of fascism. There is a methodology that social scientists put together. They studied what everybody would agree to be fascist regimes since the founding of modernity. They're called 14 characteristics of fascism. Look it up. Look at the qualitative description of each one of those characteristics and ask yourself, what is happening in this country? Do we have explicit fascism? Well, we don't actually have concentration camps, but we clearly have a circumstance where a billionaire class are ruling the political class. We certainly have a situation where Monsanto Corporation is actually controlling agricultural policy in this country, where we have Shell Oil and Exxon Oil and other oil and gas corporations controlling energy policy in this country. We have the health maintenance organizations and insurance corporations controlling healthcare policy in this country. So what I would say is, it's a hard question, and I know that we're concluding, I'll stick around, but I'll tell you this. I genuinely believe, and I know that we're being recorded, and so I look right into the camera, we are living in a time where we are experiencing a kinder, gentler fascism. We are seeing our democratic state literally controlled by powerful corporate interests, and we have very little ability to influence it individually. And that, I'm going to turn it back around to the reason why we need a mass movement. That mass movement must be broad. It must cut across ideology, faith, non-faith. It must cut across race and gender, class. It actually has to be very broad, and it must be deep. It must actually be conviction. We've got to have the same level of courage and dedication that past social movements have experienced in this country. And it's got to be educated and conscious about what the hell is actually happening, right? We can't just react. We have to actually begin to demand, and here is what I think we demand. I think we demand that we want a country and a world that is peaceful, just, democratic, ecologically sustainable, where human beings' individual rights are respected under law and in our culture.
As always, we value your feedback on the show. Have a comment or question for today's guests? Have a suggestion for a guest you'd like us to interview? Email us at humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Thank you again for listening to The Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association.